behavior?
Not at all. I mean, Representative Lafferty, the same representative who tried to justify the three-fifths compromise in the Constitution a couple of years ago, I mean, he can act, you know, out of decorum, out of rules, act violently, and he's welcome within his party. I mean, that's what we brought up yesterday, is that we've had so many instances of behavior. You had the Republican caucus chairman get upset at his son's basketball game and pull down the pants of the referee. That, you know, does not merit any type of sanction. You had a member who admitted to being a child molester, Representative David Byrd. He sat there without being expelled. You have David Hawk, you know, who was, you know, guilty of domestic violence. I mean, these things happened, and there was no accountability. But for us, for exercising our First Amendment activity, for saying that, you know, we took our oath seriously to protest against and dissent from any legislation that is injurious to the people, Article 2, Section 27 of the state constitution, we took that seriously. They expelled us, the most serious measure taken against us. And it's wrong, it's shameful. And what it really was about trying to silence the voices of the 78,000 people each of us represent in the most diverse districts in the state.
Can you tell us, and this is an absolutely key point, you represent the largest and most diverse cities in Tennessee. The local governing bodies, for example, of Metro Nashville, could reappoint you immediately?
That's what we're hearing. The question will be, will the Republican supermajority seat us? And so, I mean, we would have to still run in a special election, and will the speaker seat us back in the body? Or will this be a legal battle? Just like Julian Bond, you know, they refused to seat him in Georgia when he was a young man who ran for the legislature during the Civil Rights Movement. And so we don't know what to expect. I mean, I don't think the nation, what happened yesterday was unprecedented, and it should alarm us all that if it can happen in Tennessee, it can happen anywhere. And so I hope that people are paying attention. I hope that people realize that this is authoritarianism, that this is ousting of opposition voices from a legislative body is authoritarianism. This is not democracy. I know I'm on democracy now. But this is definitely not what democracy looks like. And we are on a very scary path toward fascism, toward authoritarianism, toward autocracy in Tennessee, the birthplace of the Ku Klux Klan.
And let's remember the significance of this week. I mean, this is the week of April 4th, April 4th, 1968, Memphis, Tennessee. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was gunned down, and we're also here talking about gun violence that began this protest you were involved with, Justin Jones. But so there was the Tennessee Three, you, Justin Pearson, and Gloria Johnson. You both are 27. She's 60 years old. You are both black. She is white. She made no bones about this. She said the reason she was not expelled and you two were was the color of your skin. At the end, I was watching and walking through the streets of New York, watching on my phone what was happening. And when Justin Pearson gave his final comments, the Tennessee feed from the House of Representatives called him Justin Pearson, like they couldn't tell the difference between the two of you.
Yeah, they called him, they confused his name, Justin Jones.
Oh, sorry, called him Justin Jones, your name.
Yeah. I mean, that is it, is that they saw two young black men who, you know, speak up on the House floor, you know, speak up in committees and challenge this dominant narrative of white supremacy, of plantation capitalism, of patriarchy. And that terrified them, that we, you know, were the two youngest lawmakers. I'm 27, Pearson's 28. And that, you know, we represent the future of this state. And that is what they're trying to stop, is that they want to hold on to this old South when we're trying to bring a renewed South that uplifts human rights and democracy, multiracial democracy, and social justice. And so what we saw yesterday was a public lynching, let's be real. And it was meant to set an example, but we did not bow down. And that's what I think has them, you know, really upset, is that we didn't bow down. They wanted us to, you know, to feel broken, but we left with our fist up in the air because we knew that that this was not the end, that they may expel us, but they can't expel our movements. And that's what terrifies them.
Well, Justin Jones, I want to thank you for being with us. Of course, we'll continue to follow this. A major protest is planned for Monday, I know. Will you be out there?
I definitely will. I'll be outside of that chamber with these young people showing up every week until we take action to take these weapons of war off our street and until we honor the victims of Covenant Elementary School by acting.
Justin Jones expelled Democratic Tennessee State Representative representing Nashville, author of The People's Plaza, 62 Days of Nonviolent Resistance, with a foreword by Bishop William Barber. Thanks so much for being with us. Coming up, we go to the Middle East. Israel's bombed southern Lebanon and Gaza's tensions soar in the region after Israeli forces repeatedly raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque, beating and tear-gassing Palestinian worshippers during Ramadan. Stay with us.
Last night, I prayed on a falling star that you'll never have a broken heart. Though the world is cold, just remember who you are. And I pray that you'll never have a rainy day. And no matter what people say, even when it hurts, it'll be
Prayer by Kay Michelle. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel bombs southern Lebanon, Gaza overnight as tensions soar in the region. Days after Israeli police repeatedly attacked Palestinian worshippers inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied East Jerusalem. In response to the Israeli raids on the mosque, militants in southern Lebanon and Gaza fired dozens of rockets into Israel, the largest rocket attack from Lebanon in 17 years. Israel says most of the rockets were intercepted. Meanwhile, earlier today, two Israeli sisters were shot dead, their mother critically wounded in a shooting near an illegal settlement in the occupied West Bank. Israeli authorities are searching for the perpetrators. This all comes as Israel continues to impose a violent crackdown in the occupied West Bank, where the Israeli army has killed at least 94 Palestinians this year. Israel's raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan have sparked international condemnation. Palestinian worshippers said they were beaten and tear-gassed as they prayed.
We were spending the night in the mosque, and after we were done with late-night prayers, the police started to evacuate worshippers from the outdoor yards. We were inside, and the young men closed the doors, but police stormed in and detained the young men and women. There were other worshippers to the eastern part of the compound. In the yard to the eastern part of the compound, the police were firing tear gas and stun grenades. It was a scene that I can't describe. Then they stormed in and started beating everyone, and they detained people, and they put the young men on their faces to the ground. They also beat them while in detention.
Joining us now is Mohammed Kurd. He is the Palestine representative for The Nation, where he recently wrote an article titled, Israeli Protesters Say They're Defending Freedom, Palestinians Know Better. Mohammed Kurd is from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of occupied East Jerusalem. Mohammed, welcome back to Democracy Now! What is happening right now in Israel and Palestine?
Good morning. What is happening has been a crackdown on Palestinians from the Israeli regime on all levels. But it's important to remember, and it's important to contextualize that these tensions that may arise and this kind of violence that may, quote-unquote, erupt does not happen in a vacuum, and it does not happen in isolation of the larger settler colonial enterprise, of the larger military occupation that Palestinians are forced to live under. As you said, there have been 94 Palestinians killed since the start of this year, and that within itself is an escalation of violence. But in the past 2 days, Israelis who have been emboldened by international impunity, by international inaction, have been using the bodies and using the site of Al-Aqsa Mosque as a stage to display brute force to send a message of sovereignty and security to the Israeli public, as well as send a message of intimidation to the Palestinians who use that mosque as one of their only remaining public spaces in a shrinking city.
Can you explain what you understand happened in Al-Aqsa?
Yes, well, according to eyewitness reports and according to the video footage that has been circulated all over the internet, as well as TV channels, Israeli occupation forces stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque. They used rubber bullets. They used tear gas, stun grenades. They used butts of their rifles to beat on the worshippers and arrest a mass number of them. Over 400 worshippers were detained, and then they were handed orders preventing them, denying them entry to Al-Aqsa Mosque or the Old City for 15 days. Later that day, an armed Israeli settler, which, by the way, many of the settlers who live in East Jerusalem are armed, shot a 15-year-old boy in the Old City of Jerusalem. And of course, to no one's surprise, the settler was not arrested.
And explain what's happening from Gaza and Lebanon. You've got this barrage of rockets in response to Al-Aqsa going into Israel. And then you have Israel rocketing Lebanon, though they were careful to say they weren't calling out Hezbollah, but saying Palestinian militants. And it looks like Lebanon is not trying to escalate this.
Absolutely. It seems like the internal chasm that is splitting apart Israeli society today might prevent them from entering a fully scaled war, which is why I assume they have been very cautious in their wording. But we must understand that the Palestinian people, regardless of the geography, regardless of the legal status, be it in a refugee camp in Lebanon or in besieged in the Gaza Strip, are one people and they feel each other's pain. It's not just retaliation for Al-Aqsa Mosque. I mean, the Israeli regime has been bombing Syria for well over a year. It has been bombing the Gaza Strip on and off for the past 15 years. And the most important piece of context here is that we must remember that the Gaza Strip is an open-air prison, the largest in the world. This is a densely populated refugee camp where people do not have an inch to stretch. People do not have the right to movement. People do not have access to clean water. It has been declared uninhabitable. That, within itself, is an aggression.
You mentioned the Israeli settlers in Jerusalem and Israelis carrying guns. I wanted to ask you about Itamar Ben-Gvir, Israel's new minister of national security, ultra-nationalist convicted of racist incitement against Palestinians and supporting a terrorist group. In October, he waved a gun and shouted. This was during a confrontation in your neighborhood, Mohammed, in Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem, where settlers attempted to violently evict your family and others from their homes. Just going to play a brief clip.
If they, Palestinians, throw stones, shoot them.
Explain what he was saying and what he did.
Absolutely. I've had a few interactions with Ben-Gvir and also Smotrich. And, you know, while adjectives like far right and ultra nationalists certainly do describe him, these adjectives make him sound as though he is fringe, as though he is marginal, when in fact he represents, I would argue, a large portion of the mainstream. You must understand that these politicians use our neighborhoods, use our front yards as avenues for political campaigning. These displays of racism, these displays of brutality, these threats, this, all of them serve to embolden and bolster his election campaign, which was insanely successful. He is now the Minister of National Security. This has been a pattern with Itamar Ben-Gvir, but he is just a man saying the quiet part out loud. Truly, the differences between him and the liberal Zionist parties are purely cosmetic. He is willing to say in public what they say behind closed doors and what their policies and what the laws that they have put forth have done for the Palestinians for the past seven decades. They've all been policies and laws and actions of racism, ones that promote ethnic cleansing, ones that reek of racism.
Let me ask you, Mohammed Al-Kurd, about the massive Israeli protests, not about treatment of Palestinians, but about what Netanyahu wants to do to the Supreme Court, severely curtail the powers of the judiciary. Can you talk about whether you think they will transform into supporting Palestinians, and also the mainstream media's coverage of what's happening right now with the escalating violence?
I mean, I want to, you know, watching the protests, I want to tell the Israeli public that they have a lot more in common than they realize, because the body that they are protesting to defend, the body that they are trying desperately to save, the Supreme Court, which they say is a beacon of democracy, has its fingerprints all over the Israeli government's settler colonial enterprise and apartheid regime. I mean, this is the same Supreme Court that in 2018, when the Israeli occupation forces created a generation of martyrs and amputees in the Gaza Strip following the Great March of Return, ruled that they were doing so in self-defense. This is the same Supreme Court that upheld the legality of the family reunification law, which prevents tens of thousands of Palestinian couples and families of living together and uniting together. This is the same Supreme Court that in January ruled, in complete violation of international law, to forcibly expel over 1,300 Palestinians from Safar Yatta. And one of the Supreme Court judges, which made this ruling possible, by the way, is himself a settler in the West Bank. So this is the body that these people are trying to defend. So I absolutely do not think they can transform into talking about or protecting the rights or defending the lives or being advocates of the Palestinian Liberation Movement, because they are defending a body that is settler-made and that serves settlers and that was built on top of the rubble of Palestinian lands and that was made to ethnically cleanse Palestinians and to legalize that kind of ethnic cleansing.
Do you think that there is growing resentment about what the government is doing to Palestinians when it comes to these massive protests?
I wonder. I mean, they have been able to show us that they can mobilize in the hundreds of thousands, and they can speak up, and they can do all of the civil disobedience. They can engage in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign against their own government. They have been showing us this, and we're just told that they're just not choosing to do it in favor of the Palestinians, which makes sense. I mean, defending the lives of Palestinians or protesting against the apartheid regime or the settler colonial regime would mean that they have to undermine their own privileges and the own luxuries they enjoy as settlers in historic Palestine.
Well, Mohammed Al-Kurd, we want to thank you for being with us, Palestine correspondent for The Nation. We'll link to your latest piece at democracynow.org. Coming up, calls are growing for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas to be impeached after ProPublica reveals Thomas has frequently taken free luxury trips paid for by a Republican billionaire, Harlan Crow. Stay with us.
الشوارع اعتقالات آلاف الأسرى في السجون حصار يقصفون المدن والقرى يفرقون مظاهرات السلام بالغاز المسيل للدموع بالرصاص بالصواريخ بالقذائف بالمدافع بالنار بالرصاص بالصواريخ بالقذائف بالمدافع
and the the Freedom by Rimbana and Onur Koç. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas is facing renewed calls for his impeachment after a ProPublica investigation revealed he failed to report frequent luxury trips paid for by a billionaire Republican megadonor named Harlan Crow, who serves on the board of the right-wing American Enterprise Institute. The investigation reveals that for about 20 years, Thomas secretly accepted luxury vacations from Crow, an apparent violation of a law requiring justices and other federal officials to disclose most gifts. One vacation involved 9 days of island hopping in Indonesia aboard a 162-foot superyacht. Clarence Thomas and his wife, Ginny Thomas, flew to Indonesia on Crow's private jet. Thomas also frequently vacationed at Crow's 105-acre resort in the Adirondacks of New York. Hanging on the walls of the resort is a painting of Clarence Thomas sitting with four other men, including Harlan Crow, as well as Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society. Thomas never reported any of the free trips as gifts. On Thursday, New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted, quote, "This is beyond party or partisanship. This degree of corruption is shocking, almost cartoonish. Thomas must be impeached," she said. We're joined now by Justin Elliott, who co-authored the ProPublica investigation headlined Clarence Thomas and the Billionaire. Lay out what you found, Justin.
Yeah, well, what we found is that Justice Thomas has this extraordinary and, you know, apparently unprecedented relationship with this outside billionaire who, you know, is basically subsidizing his life. I mean, we're talking about trips on a private jet that, you know, charters for $10,000 to $15,000 per hour. Cruises around the world on the super yacht that you described, regular vacations with this billionaire and his friends, who in some cases are people that have either ideological or potentially financial interests before the court.
Well, explain what the rules are for Supreme Court justices.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the striking things here as we got into this is that is just how few rules there are, especially compared to other people in the government. You know, I've friends who work in the federal bureaucracy who say they can't even, you know, have somebody buy them lunch. Supreme Court justices have very few rules in terms of accepting gifts. One of the few things the law requires them to do is to simply disclose gifts, most gifts. This was a law that was passed back in the 1970s after Watergate. And Clarence Thomas, by not reporting these private jet trips and some of the other travel, you know, appears to be in just repeat violation of that law, according to the ethics lawyers we spoke to.
So I wanted to read from your investigation. Thomas's frequent vacations at Top Ridge have brought him into contact with corporate executives and political activists. During one trip in 2017, his fellow guests included executives at Verizon, PricewaterhouseCoopers, major Republican donors, one of the leaders of the American Enterprise Institute, a pro-business conservative think tank, according to the records you reviewed. The painting of Thomas at Top Ridge, and so I want to show this for our TV audience, shows him in conversation, as we said earlier, with Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society. Explain who the other people are and what Top Ridge is.
Yeah, Top Ridge is this incredible, essentially private resort in upstate New York in the Adirondacks. It was actually built by Marjorie Meriwether Post, who is the same heiress who built what is now Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago about a century ago, to give you a sense of the kind of lavishness of the property. This property is now owned by this Dallas real estate billionaire, Harlan Crow, and he regularly hosts Thomas there. And we're not talking about just sort of a lake house. It's a whole campus of buildings. There's a staff of chefs and waiters and that sort of thing. And, you know, it's very difficult to find out who is on these trips with Justice Thomas. We were able to get the names of guests on one or two occasions. And even though Harlan Crow, you know, told us in a statement that he and his friends are not trying to influence Justice Thomas, you know, the people, for example, in the painting you describe are—
And what is the sculpture behind them?
Yeah, it's a sculpture of a Native American man sort of with his hands outstretched. We're not really sure why it's there, what it's supposed to mean. I actually spoke to the painter who created the piece, and, you know, he said that in real life that sculpture is actually two or three times bigger, and he shrunk it in the painting because for scale. But we don't really know why it's there or why they made the choice to pose in front of it. But, you know, all of the men in the painting, besides Harlan Crow, are conservative lawyers, people who are active in one way or another in the conservative legal movement, you know.
Of course, Leonard Leo, key to the choosing of conservative justices, especially under Trump.
Yeah, Leonard Leo has been very involved in creating the current Supreme Court supermajority, and Harlan Crow has donated to Leonard Leo's groups, and this is a guy who, you know, now has a war chest of like over $1 billion, and you know, again, when you look at that painting, it raises a lot of questions about Harlan Crow's statement that this is all about sort of friendship and just socializing.
So tell us more about who Harlan Crow, the billionaire GOP super donor, is. Can you tell us more about Harlan Crow? Can you hear me? Can you hear me, Justin? All right. While he's fixing his IFB, Justin Elliott writes in the piece that Clarence Thomas has presented himself as a, quote, every man with modest tastes. We're going to turn to a clip right now of Justice Thomas speaking in the documentary Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in his own words.
You know, I don't have any problem with going to Europe, but I prefer the United States. And I prefer seeing the regular parts of the United States. I prefer going across the rural areas. I prefer the RV parks. I prefer the Walmart parking lots to the beaches and things like that. There's something normal to me about it. I come from regular stock, and I prefer that. I prefer being around that.
That's Clarence Thomas. Your response to that, Justin Elliott, and if you can tell us more about the man he spends a lot of time with, even if he extols Walmart parking lots, and that is Harlan Crow.
Yeah, well, a couple thoughts. I mean, one is irony is the documentary you just showed, which was made by friends of Justice Thomas. It was actually financed in part by with hundreds of thousands of dollars from none other than Harlan Crow. And yeah, there's been a deliberate effort over the years by Clarence Thomas and his supporters to present him as a kind of every man, a regular guy who likes driving around in his RV. And you know, he absolutely does drive around in his RV around the country. But, you know, they've never mentioned that he also is flying around on private jets and going around on yachts, hanging out at resorts, you know, essentially private sort of boutique luxury hotels hosted by this billionaire. That has somehow never come up in all these interviews he's given about his RV. So it's you know, starkly different than the reality. With respect to Harlan Crow, I mean, he's you know, he was actually born into money. He was an heir to a major Dallas real estate fortune. He was the son who took over the family business. So he has wide-ranging business interests, particularly in real estate. But I think more relevant for this story, he's also been involved for you know, over 20 years now in conservative legal politics, giving to groups like the Federalist Society and others. As you mentioned earlier, he's a longtime board member of the American Enterprise Institute, the think tank, which, of course, is active on a lot of issues, but including conservative legal advocacy and you know, advocating for various things related to the Supreme Court. So he's very deep in the kind of political world and specifically the world of conservative legal politics.
And says that the greatest threat is Marxism. Is that right, Justin?
Yeah, and he didn't agree to interview to an interview with us, but he gave an interview recently in which he said his greatest fear is Marxism.
Well, we're going to leave it there. As you write in ProPublica, soon after Crow met Thomas 3 decades ago, he began lavishing the justice with gifts, including a $19,000 Bible that belonged to Frederick Douglass. Justin Elliott, will link to your ProPublica report, Clarence Thomas and the Billionaire. A very happy birthday to Matt Ely. I'm Amy Goodman. Tune in to democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
Build food security in your community. This holiday season, we're thrilled to announce that the SFU Community Free Fridge is available to staff, students, and faculty. The fridge is conveniently located on the first level of the Student Union Building on Burnaby campus. We encourage all our community members to enjoy the fridge, or better yet, volunteer with friends to clean and stock it. Thank you to the organizations who made this initiative possible, including the SFSS, Embark Sustainability, the Burnaby Primary Care Network, Food Mesh, Burnaby Neighborhood House, SFU Ancillary Services, and SFU's Office of Community Engagement. Visit sfss.ca/news and follow @BurnabyFridge on Instagram to find out more.